Welcome to We've Got Issues. I am Joshua Holland. Liz Prezza is off this week. She's communing with nature or something. And just a heads up, I will be off next week. We'll be back the week after. We'll miss Liz, but we do have one of my favorite guests this week, Oliver Willis. He is a senior writer at ShareBlue.com. He is also a savvy media critic. I've got a bunch of things I want to talk to him about, including a little point of disagreement that we fought over on Twitter this week. First, a few news items you may have missed. Back when the Trump regime rolled back Obama-era fuel efficiency standards, many automakers were like, we don't actually want that. And since then, a number of the leading auto manufacturers have entered into agreement with California that will maintain strict emission standards. Something similar happened this week. Trump's EPA relaxed limits on methane, or methane for our British listeners, which is a much more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. I don't know why they believe that they are going to be immune to the impacts of climate change. Actually, I do know that they just don't believe it. But in any event, Julia Elperin reports for The Washington Post that they made this move over the objections of the industry. Specifically, three of the leading oil and gas companies asked the regime to keep these limits in place. And I just want to point out that this is a degree of corporate fealty or wing nuttery that we've never really seen. I mean, usually we worry about these agencies being like captured by the industries that they're regulating. And now those industries are like, guys, this is nuts. And they just ignore them. So it's very strange. On Thursday, Trump attended a ceremony to launch his Space Force to combat space pirates, I guess. And the problem is that there is no Space Force. Congress has yet to give final approval for this new sub-agency. And I say sub-agency because this whole Space Force joke, it's good for late-night comedians. I enjoy it because I have to do a little, you know, intro to this show. But it has been about trying to soothe the man-baby-in-chief. Trump wanted his Space Force to be a new branch of the military. Remember, but the Pentagon kind of quietly made it a sub-agency of the Air Force, which already had such a program. So they had a program with space capabilities, and they said, sure, we'll give you your Space Force. And I guess they just kind of like changed. I don't know what they're used to call this internal program. I guess they just called it the Air Force, but I guess they're now rebranding it Space Force, and maybe they'll get like new stationery, which says Space Force, or t-shirts. Anyway, America, fuck yeah. ProPublica had two stories this month about political hacks in the Trump regime overruling prosecutors to spare corporate criminals from being punished. Earlier this month, they reported that, and I quote, political appointees at the Trump administration Justice Department took the unusual step of overruling staff prosecutors to reduce the settlements, unquote, against two big banks, two big UK-based banks, Barclays and the Royal Bank of Scotland. This was for, quote, financial crisis era misdeeds. The authors of that piece note, and again, I quote, since Donald Trump's election, federal white-collar enforcement has taken a big hit. Fines and settlements against corporations have plummeted. This is actually not news. Then this week, ProPublica again reported that line prosecutors had been set to bring criminal charges against Monsanto, the giant agribusiness, for spraying an illegal toxic nerve agent. So Trump appointees just quashed those charges entirely. And I just let that roll around in your head. Illegal toxic nerve agent. Trump has slow walked $250 million in military assistance to Ukraine. Now he is reportedly trying to figure out how to block it entirely, according to CNN. the money is seen as a signal to Russia that they can't operate in Ukraine with complete impunity. And honestly, I think one can make an argument that we shouldn't be giving military assistance to the Ukraine, But Trump has basically no credibility when he claims that he's just looking out for America's interests, you know, given all of the context. And I'll tell you, I don't know if Russia has something on Trump or not, but if they don't, then his supine behavior or supine approach to the Kremlin is really pathetic. And speaking of pathetic, as we approach hurricane season, Trump's Department of Homeland Security announced that it is reprogramming $270 million that Congress allocated for disaster relief to the border area, to beefing up security, I think. And this is, you know, again, as a hurricane is bearing down on Florida, or tropical storm at this point. Here's a Trump effect story. There was a 14-year-old kid in Lancaster, Texas. He went to school without a belt. Now, I did not know that belts were required, but apparently they are. And the student, who is a citizen of but a Latino, was threatened by with deportation by a school employee. And not only was he not wearing a belt, he also said "yeah" instead of "yes, sir," because I guess it's 1955. According to the boy's family, the teacher told the kid, and I quote, "Even though you are a citizen, Trump is working on a law where he can deport you too." And he said that that was because of his mom's status, but mom says she is a lawful permanent resident. The teacher has been suspended. Finally, there's a story you should be tracking about the Supreme Court. It has to do with a gun case that Democrats say is moot and should not be heard, and conservatives are hoping will lead the court to once again expand the right of everyone to pack heat. The details don't matter as much as a brief, a really stunning brief that several Democratic senators sent to the court. It was written by Sheldon Whitehouse, who is an independent but caucuses with Dems. And in it, he basically argued that the court has become a partisan organ of the Republican Party, and that if it continues on that path, it will lose all legitimacy or whatever legitimacy it still enjoys. And there was a veiled threat. It's a remarkable brief. You can read about it. If you Google Ian Millhiser at Think Progress, he wrote a whole piece about this letter, this brief that the Democrats filed. So there was a veiled threat that at some point, Democrats would no longer tolerate five robed tyrants overturning laws passed by a democratically elected legislature. And this week, all 53 Senate Republicans filed an opposing brief whining that White House had, quote, openly threatened this court with political retribution if it failed to dismiss the petition as moot. They said the justices must not be, quote, cowed. But listen, you guys built this. I think they will eventually come to rue the day they blocked Merrick Garland from even getting a hearing. There is a certain feistiness within the Democratic coalition about court issues that we have not seen previously, certainly on the left. And, you know, for many, many years, we've talked about this before on the show, for many, many years, the right called into question the legitimacy of the court, while the left tended to criticize individual decisions and not question the very fact that you have these people who are given lifetime appointments and are able to just kill laws that are have majority support. And I think that that is changing. And I think that that change can have long lasting ramifications. Anyway, with that, let's move on. We will take a quick break and then come right back with Oliver Willis. Stay tuned. Welcome back. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I am always really happy to have my next guest on the show. In addition to being one of the best people to follow on Twitter, at @owillis, Oliver Willis is also a senior writer at ShareBlue. Oliver Willis, welcome to We've Got Issues.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for taking the time. Oliver and I go back a ways, and we've long bonded over our shared disdain for feckless Democrats, hand-wringing.
Yeah. Yep.
And our contempt for both the dishonesty of the conservative press and the kind of pathetic mewling of many ostensibly neutral journalists. And we do, however, disagree about one recent development, which we're going to get to in a minute or two. But first, Oliver, is there anyone at the New York Times who hasn't blocked you on Twitter?
Let's see. That's a good question. I'd say about 80% of them have so far. One or two haven't, but like I think that's usually mostly because I don't go after them as much as like the bigwigs, as the Maggie Habermans of the world. But yeah, I don't think, you know, little old me is not very popular with the New York Times crowd, which it's always kind of funny to me because, you know, sometimes whenever I fight with them, I'll have someone pop up all of a sudden and say like, oh, the left is going after the New York Times. And I'm like, where have you been? I've been doing this for almost 20 years at this point, complaining about the New York Times. Like, you know, everyone that's like, oh, this is new. What happened to the Times lately? And I'm like, where have you been for the last two decades, buddy? You know, join the club, join the crowd.
I should just note that Oliver spent many years at Media Matters before moving on to ShareBlue. And I think that the people who have not yet blocked him are like the movie critics and the poetry people.
Yeah. Whatever. And, the ones that aren't terrible, the ones that actually produce something of value at that paper.
That's it. I should note that the New York Times social media guidelines say please refrain from blocking people for merely criticizing you or your work.
Yeah.
It seems like they bend over backwards to soothe their conservative critics, but they have the thinnest skin when it comes to criticism from our side. Why do you think that is?
Well, yeah, you know, that's a good point you brought up there. Like, I you know, I started in the early blogosphere, like in the early 2000s. And like, I feel like that built up my hide a lot with like, you know, dealing with criticism. Like, it comes with the territory. If you have any sort of profile when you're writing about politics, you're going to take criticism and you're going to take incoming flack. And yeah, it's strange to me how the New York Times basically has not prepared, apparently, any of their people for taking on criticism. And when they do get criticized from the right, you know, they always hop to it and, you know, please, sir, you know, don't say these mean things about us. We're not biased. But if someone on the left does it, it's this really snotty attitude that they come at you with. Like, you know, I have to say, like, Maggie Haberman, who's like basically their star, you know, politics reporter, she's the worst with this. Like, if you come at her from the left with criticism, it's as if she's never heard someone criticize her work before. And the venom that she goes out, it's never with the tone of like, okay, well, I don't necessarily agree with the way that you're talking about this, but I hear your criticism. Instead, it's a total full-blown attack.
And it drips with condescension. I think that they've embraced the conservatives' long-standing you know, attacks on the press as being biased towards liberals, so that when they get it from the right, they're like, wait, we are liberals. It makes sense that they're going to give us shit. And when they get it from the left, they're like, wait a second, I'm supposed to have a liberal bias. Like, why are you even giving me a hard time? I want to get your take on a media kerfuffle this week. There's one every week. There's one every day.
Yeah, right.
Beto O'Rourke, he is trying to reboot his campaign in part by going after stupid mainstream reporting in viral ways. It's not enough to win my support, but I do appreciate it. This week, he went after conservative media. He didn't even go after them. They started this thing.
Yeah.
He booted Breitbart editor Joel Pollack from an event at Benedict College, which is a historically black college in South Carolina. And the entire mainstream press corps took to the fainting couches, basically, about what they called a brazen assault on the press. They all took to Twitter to condemn the Beto campaign for doing this. It seems to me that there was exponentially more outrage over this than there was when the White House yanked press credentials from Brian Karam, who is Playboy's White House correspondent, after Karam got yelled at by Sebastian Gorka in a Rose Garden ceremony. Is that just my perception?
No, I think you're dead on with this. You also saw it happen when Bernie Sanders, you know, criticized the media too. It's this thing where they in their heads, I think, because we on the left don't have like this sort of destructive attitude towards journalism, right? I think our tactic with journalism differs so much from the right in that the right just does not want journalism. The right wants, you know, they want Fox News, they want hagiography, they want someone cheerleading for them. We on our side said, okay, we want journalism. We don't necessarily like it when, you know, you go after our guys, but if it's fair and it's based on reality, you know, nail them. And that's not what the right wants. The right does not want adversarial journalism at any time. So, you know, the press, I think, has sort of had this attitude of, well, the left is on our team. And so when the left, you know, criticizes the mainstream journalists, it's viewed as this like betrayal, like you guys are supposed to have our back no matter what, even if we're trashing your own guys. And so when Beto, you know, calls him out and he just excluded Breitbart, who Breitbart is, you know, it's not journalism. It's not even opinion journalism. That's the thing. Like, I write for an outlet that has a point of view, you know, a progressive point of view. But we at least adhere to, like, the rules of journalism. Breitbart is just in it to get Republicans to win and to push conservatives and to do it with using really dirty, underhanded tactics, racism, you know, all sorts of bias, that sort of thing. Like, they're not really a journalistic outlet. They're just, you know, a far-right arm of the Republican Party movement, right? And so, you know, just Beto pushing back on it slightly, and you had the New York Times, who, like, Breitbart has tried to undermine the Times. Like, yeah, you had the New York Times rushing to their defense. And it's this thing where, like, they don't get it. They just really don't get it. And they're so reflexive of liberal critiques of the media that, you know, even defending the gutter, the underbelly gutter of the right, they're more than willing to do it.
You know, you made an important point there, because I don't think that it is about neutrality versus being a progressive or conservative publication. You know, I've written for unapologetically progressive outlets for 15 years. I've edited for maybe 9 of those years, and I have made some errors for sure, but I've never published anything that I had reason to believe was not accurate. And that is not what Breitbart is about. And the thing about this particular kerfuffle, and listeners, if they're not familiar with Breitbart, I'm sure most of them are, but like, it used to have this black crime section. It's just, they're full of shit. And while I agree, like, I agree with the premise that it is not acceptable to bar journalists from an open event, including adversarial journalists. It's okay that Breitbart wants to get Republicans elected, as far as I'm concerned. It is the lack of fealty to not neutrality, but accuracy that I think separates them from even like National Review. Like, National Review doesn't publish. I mean, I don't want to defend National Review too much, but they have fact checkers, I think.
Right. Like, they at least have themselves somewhat rooted in reality. Now, I mean, you can say like their analysis is bullshit, right? Yes. Like, their analysis is bullshit. But generally speaking, you know, being really broad here, because like you said, it's hard to be fair to the National Review.
Yeah, we don't want to like puff up the National Review too much. But there's a qualitative difference there.
Right. Like, I mean, one of the outlets I like to use to talk about this as an example is the Wall Street Journal. Not the editorial side, but the news side. The Wall Street Journal is a conservative publication, but their news side is actually legitimate journalism. And they actually sort of adhere to, you know, they have a mindset, but they adhere to reality and the rules. And I mean, you know, places you've written for, places I've written for, Media Matters, Share Blue. Like, yes, we have a point of view and we're very clear about that, but like, you can't just invent facts to fit that narrative. Whereas Breitbart does that all the time. I mean, I've personally been attacked by Breitbart with something they completely made up. A few years ago, they attacked me as being anti-Israeli. And like, they had to like come up with these quotes where I said, we should take an even-handed approach to the Middle Eastern process. And they, and they spun that into, I'm anti-Israel, which that just shows, goes to show you, like, you know, I mean, Josh, as you know, my opinions on most issues are pretty out there. Like, I'm not really shy about my point of view. So the fact that they had to kind of invent one tells you, I think, everything you need to know about Breitbart and their approach to the world.
Folks, I can confirm that Oliver is not ashamed of expressing his point of view. So, okay, so this was the thing that really bothered me about the about the whole brouhaha. It was the uncritical assumption that Pollack was acting as a journalist, because, again, I do believe it's wrong to bar journalists. And I had this exchange on Twitter with Andrew Feinberg. He acknowledged that Breitbart is, let me quote, because I have it here, often a cesspool of bad faith and worse. But then he said it is, quote, anti-democratic and gives others a signal that they can exclude outlets they dislike. So yeah, it's a cesspool of bad faith and worse, but it's just a matter of excluding outlets they dislike. That's contradictory. Then he goes, it's wrong when Donald Trump does it, and it's just wrong, as wrong in this case. So I tell him, look, the central point of contention is whether Pollack is a reporter covering a campaign. And his response was that he's a paid correspondent on assignment. And I'm like,
oh, come on.
I'm like, you know what? State-run media, when they send people out, they pay them. They give them assignments. Like, it's
worse than state-run media, because, I mean, even some state-run media sort of, you know, put up some sort of journalistic pretense. Like, Pollack is out there as he's a provocateur. I mean, a few weeks ago, he was on the line with Joe Biden he hit Biden with basically, if I remember correctly, it was like a fake or, you know, fabricated or truncated quote, trying to get a rise out of Biden on something. And Biden called him on it. And that's the kind of guy that he's approaching it here. He's not even like, it's not even like he's a conservative where he's like, okay, well, I'm going to give Beto a hard question at this, you know, from a right-wing point of view at this event. That's not what he's doing. He's just there to, you know, F things up. He's just there to screw around with Beto, get a viral moment, and throw it up on the Breitbart site as an example of the evil liberals coming to destroy the world. Like, it's not rooted in reality. He's a provocateur. He's basically like James O'Keefe, you know? He's basically trying to do that kind of thing, like a sting operation. And again, it's fine to have an opinion and have, you know, do journalism, but this guy's just a toad.
The thing that he hit Biden with is the same thing that he had hit O'Rourke with in a recent event, which is their ridiculous, and we don't have time to get into it too much. We talked about this on a recent show, but their ridiculous conspiracy theory about how the media has somehow made up Trump's statement that there were good people on both sides.
Oh, right, right, yeah.
Right, so which is just rank bullshit. He did that with Biden. Biden was like, what are you, get out of my face. He did that with Beto at a appearance a couple of days or a couple of weeks earlier. And, you know, that's just propaganda. And there's a similar story about a really brazen propagandist, again, snookering a bunch of mainstream journalists and, frankly, a bunch of progressive journalists. This guy named Andy Ngo, right?
Yeah.
Who recently departed Quillette after videotapes basically revealed that he had coordinated his coverage. He coordinated an attack by the Proud Boys, or was there when they coordinated it, a violent attack. The Proud Boys, by the way, are this right-wing fight club.
Militia, basically.
Basically, they travel from wherever to liberal enclaves like Portland to rumble with the locals, to rumble with anti-fascists. And while I don't condone violence at all, but when Ngo got his ass kicked at one of these events, it was widely accepted that he was a reporter working the protest and a more or less neutral observer. What was your reaction to the revelations this week that he coordinated with them, and also some of the side-by-side comparisons of how he portrayed various acts of violence at a recent protest in Portland with unedited video of what actually occurred? Because those videos really showed that he was like the Leni Riefenstahl for these far right thugs,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not, to be honest, the sad part is I'm not surprised, because this is what the right always does. There's not any serious right-wing journalism in America. And every time one of these guys comes out and says, you know, I was attacked, I was, you know, poor put upon me, I always tell people, especially on our side of the aisle, just wait a minute before you jump on top of this thing, because inevitably, you know, video will come out showing the full context of what happened. And yeah, you know, don't attack someone, don't physically attack someone, but there's always context that they leave out of these things, because unfortunately, they understand the way that the mainstream media and even progressive media interprets these things. You see, you know, a quick video clip of something, it looks horrible, everybody wants to condemn it because you want to say, you know, oh, the bad thing is bad, you know, don't do the bad thing.
You want to be virtuous. You want to be virtuous.
Right, right. It's virtue signal. Right. And at the end of the day, though, the problem is these guys, in my opinion, they have not built up enough trust to earn that benefit of the doubt, right? There's just too many years of this. This has gone on for, you know, honestly, 20, 30, 40 years of this. And you go back and you look at the, you know, there's been sort of a 50-year campaign to discredit the mainstream media from the conservative side of things. And that's what, you know, this is a product of that because they've been beat up so long in this sort of relationship that when a right winger comes out with an accusation that doesn't pass the smell test, like if you or I came out with the same kind of video, they would be a lot more skeptical of it because we're not from the right side of the aisle. But if someone on the right says it, all of a sudden it's like, oh, well, this seems credible. This seems, you know, realistic. We have to take this seriously and everybody must condemn it. And every time it happens, I mean, you know, unfortunately, I watched this so many times now over the years. I'm always like, just hold on a minute, because these guys always turn out to be slime balls. I mean, you know, yeah. you have Stephen Crowder and James O'Keefe and, you know, going back to Breitbart himself when this whole thing started, like it's just over and over again. And, you know, it's Sean Hannity, it's Rush Limbaugh. It's the same thing. It's just different players every few years. And Andy Ngo is just the latest and there'll be more after him. And it'll, you know, unfortunately, like I'm sort of resigned with it now at this point where I'm like, this is just going to always happen. It just always happens like this. And our side falls for it because we want to be the good guys. That's the
fall for it every time. And, yeah. you know, even after it's exposed, and you're right, it happens just again and again, and nobody ever learns a thing. And that's frustrating to me. You may be resigned. Yeah. I am not. It pisses me off. I'm like, we should have some sort of collective memories that we understand that this has happened again and again and again. And these people are working
within an
excess of bad faith. And let me make one point here. These people are deeply steeped in the idea that the neutral media is not just biased, because bias is a subconscious process. We're not aware of bias. They believe that the press makes up shit to damage conservatives and Republicans. And they have internalized that belief to a degree that they feel justified to make shit up to damage liberals and Democrats because they think that turnabout is fair play.
Yeah, they use it as an excuse, right? Because like the way that they talk about the way the interaction between Democrats and the media is, and I've joked about this on my Twitter feed, but they literally act as if every morning the chairman of the DNC gets up and he calls the New York Times and CNN and says, how are we going to get them today? How are we going to nail them today? And you sort of see this manifest itself with Trump talking about his, you know, BS fake news thing, but they really believe it. They believe that, you know, in their view, it's almost like an opposing army, right? Where if you know the tactics of the opposing army, I mean, you know, they're willing, you know, it's like it's during a war when, I mean, even America did it, you know, during World War II. If you say like the other side is the ultimate evil and they're willing to do anything to win, that gives your side an excuse to go into the gutter and do everything to win. And even if those things aren't real, it gives you this like carte blanche to go ahead and do it. So in their view, when they're making stories up, when they're making up lies about, you know, progressives and Democrats and the mainstream media itself, it's justified because in their, you know, it's bullshit. But in their eyes, it's like, oh, well, you know, they do this to us all the time. We're just giving back, you know, what they give to us.
Yeah. I mean, I think that really explains a lot. And I remember when one of the O'Keefe's operatives tried to plant a fake story in the Washington Post. Some of her social media posts were unearthed, and she said as much. She said, we're gonna fight fire with fire. They make shit up. Yeah. We're gonna make shit up as well. All right, Oliver. Before I let you go, Lefty Fight Club. I do want to bring up our differences, folks. Oliver and I had a big disagreement on Twitter this week. I mean, it's a friendly disagreement, whatever. But
right,
and it has nothing to do with us because. It has nothing to do with us, actually. But this is about the potential benefits of deadbeat dad and former Congressman Joe Walsh's primary campaign against Trump. Oliver thinks it is pointless and won't have any impact on the 2020 race. I held my nose and threw the guy $25 because I think it could be a good investment. Yes, I did. So, Oliver, here's the thing. A very stable genius, an incumbent in a presidential race with a former congressman, you know, this guy is basically has no job. He would stay above the fray. He would act as if the guy doesn't exist, and he would leave it to surrogates to attack the guy if they bothered to attack the guy at all. Trump is not that guy. And Walsh has said, I will run this TV-centric campaign. Trump is evil Chauncey Gardner. He watches TV. It's all about TV with that guy. There is no way he is going to ignore Joe Walsh. So when he could be focusing all of his ire on the Democrats while they work their primary, instead he is going to be inflamed by Joe Walsh and lash out at him, and he's going to be looking like he's lashing out crazily at people on both the left and the right.
See, your plan makes sense on paper, right? I can't completely dismiss you out of hand for, you know, being a whack job on this thing. But my problem with this whole thing is, like, Joe Walsh has no constituency on the right, right? Like, he's supposedly attacking Trump on the right, and it's going to be this great moment of, you know, either distraction, and it's going to rip the right apart, and, you know, like, maybe it's not going to rip them, you know, completely down the middle, but it'll peel off enough and it'll give Trump trouble. And, like, I just don't see it, right? Like, I just see him as, he's maybe an annoying gnat. You know, Trump will probably throw him a bone or two by complaining about him, but he's, in the intervening years since he left Congress, he's not really been this figure on the right, like, you know, like others have been. He's like a local, you know, shock jock radio host that says racist things online. And my argument is that by giving him oxygen on the left, because that's really where he's getting it right now. Like, where is he getting his publicity? He's showing up on, you know, MSNBC TV shows, a couple CNN spots. And, you know, he was on the Sunday shows this past weekend.
Oh, but he's going on Fox. He's going on Fox this weekend.
Yeah, he's going on Fox, but, like, it'll be one hit. It's not – like, Fox is having him on to say, we covered it, right? But it's not the same sort of around-the-clock coverage that gets, you know, dumb Trump's attention. Like, Trump is, you know, attracted to the Fox and Friends of him going on heavy rotation. And I guess just my overall argument is I view it as, like, you know, a zero-sum game. Like, would I rather lift up – even a Democratic candidate that's not doing great, like Beto or you know, Castro, and say, you know, let's have another 30 seconds of a Democrat bashing him from the left, and versus elevating this guy who, like you said, is a deadbeat dad, racist, you know, dum-dum. Like, I that's how I kind of view it. Like, if I have to choose between the two, like, and I kind of view, like, the media pie as there is a zero sum to it. There's only so much, even though it seems like there's, you know, an endless amount of coverage. I'd rather give it to the progressive. Like, I just would rather hit him from the left, because I don't think anything's going to come of the Trump primary challenge thing. Like, I see that as a non-starter. Like, the party has rigged the system in his favor even more than you usually do for an incumbent president. Like, he's going to glide to the nomination with zero problems at all. Like, it's just not going to be a thing.
I totally acknowledge that Walsh is going to pick up. I do think he's going to get more than like a half of a percent of the popular vote. But I acknowledge that he is not going to win a primary or any delegates. But 2 points that I want to make here. So first, when we talk about, like, elevating people to make attacks from the left, you know, Walsh's arguments have a chance of being heard by his co-partisans in a way that Democrats don't necessarily have an opportunity. Because of negative partisanship and media siloing, you know, even the best lines of attacks from Democrats are going to fall on deaf ears. And the fact that Walsh is a belligerent wingnut who the left hates only helps him reach that group, or at least let that group be open to what he's saying. And the other point that I want to make here is that Walsh can attack Trump in ways that Democrats cannot. Like, a Democrat cannot say that Trump's presidency has been an abject failure because he was, like, unable to repeal Obamacare. He's an abject failure because he hasn't been able to build a wall on the border or significantly decrease immigration. He can hit him for like the explosion of spending and debt, right? Like things that Democrats aren't going to be credible saying.
See, I get that. I get that. And I understand what you're saying with that. But the problem is, and this might be one of those things where it's a Trump unique problem, where, okay, if you compare this, that kind of challenge in the past, you know, when you go back to George Bush the Elder, right, versus Pat Buchanan, right, like that is a rational argument that did have, you know, value within the Republican Party at that time, because Bush the Elder was seen as a sellout, you know, versus the more nativist wing in the Republican Party. But like, I feel like today's Republican Party combined with Trump, it just almost doesn't matter. Like even these attacks from the right, like it feels like when he was attacked from the right during the primary. Remember, like Marco Rubio and Jeb Bush would attack him as like, you know, not hewing to conservative orthodoxy. And I mean, what value did that do? Like the thing is, you have to add in the addition, I think, of Trump being a cult leader on top of all of it, because even these attacks from the right, they usually would work with Republicans. I mean, they even worked against George W. Bush when he got hit for, you know, spending and things like that. Like with Trump, I just feel like he has him so much in his grip as the cult leader that these sort of rational conservative attacks don't work. So like, I'd rather get, you know, motivate a progressive leaning voter. Like I just feel like the Republican voter is a lost cause. You know, I feel like if we can motivate a progressive leaning voter by having, you know, Beto out there making, you know, calling Trump a racist, I'd rather that like than trying to, you know, discourage a conservative voter. I guess that's the way I'm looking at it.
I think that sometimes it's easy to overestimate the prevalence of Trump's cult. You know, these polls, they always find that there's like, you know, if Trump is at 43% support, it'll be like 23% strongly support and 20% don't. So yeah. A Monmouth poll in February found that 4 in 10 Republicans wanted Trump to face a challenger, right? At least they wanted him to. There was a University of New Hampshire survey that found that like a majority of likely GOP primary voters say they definitely plan to back Trump, but it was like, I don't remember the exact number. I don't have it in front of me, but it was a very large number that did not say they definitely plan to back Trump. And I think that what we need to, so my take on this is that, you know, it's not going to have a huge impact on the race, but it doesn't have to, because, you know, Trump won the Electoral College thanks to 80,000 votes in 3 states. And if this guy can convince like a percent of Republicans that maybe it's just not worth it and they might as well stay home and the tariffs are fucked up and have hurt them, that could be huge. You know, that alone could be huge.
Yeah, I mean, and like I said, like, I mean, this is the thing, so, you know, folks listening should know that you and I don't, like, it's not like a vehement disagreement. Like, I totally see, you know, the validity of what you're saying here. Like, I guess it goes back to what we talked about earlier, whether you're, you know, to be slightly optimistic. Usually, it's funny because Josh and I, usually I'm the more optimistic one. And like, you know, like over the years, usually he's more optimistic and I'm the one that's like, you know, puppy dogs and rainbows and kittens. And like now I have to be the one that's like Mr. Doom and Gloom. So I'll admit that it's an unusual position for me, but you know, that's basically where I roll down it. I hope you're right. You know, like, honestly, like, I hope the boomlet, you know, causes him frustration. And then so, you know, one of the Democrats, you know, Elizabeth Warren can just like, you know, swoop in. And while he's busy fighting, you know, Walsh, Elizabeth Warren comes in and gets a massive Electoral College victory. Like, I'm more, like, in other words, I'm more than happy when it's all over. If Joe Walsh peels off a few points, I'll buy Josh dinner. And tell him, you know, congratulations, you were right. Like, and I was wrong. I'm happy to be wrong on this one.
Well, also, Oliver is right that Joe Walsh is a terrible human being and a complete scumbag and doesn't deserve my $25.
Right? Anything but that. Give it to your puppies, somebody, anybody.
I'm all in. I'm investing in anything I can. if I can get like a some sort of voodoo curse, I will get a voodoo curse. I will get a witch doctor. Oliver Willis, I believe we are out of time. Always a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Thanks for having me.
I'd also like to thank our producer and sound engineer, David Edwards, and of course the good folks at Alternet and Raw Story, John Byrne and Roxanne Cooper. You can now subscribe to the show on iTunes and Podbean and Google Play, and more coming. We're working on that. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. Of course, I would like to thank all of you good people for tuning in. We're taking off next week, but have two great weeks.
Check, check. Grateful for this life, even when I can't see the light. Praying that I make it through the fight, make it through the night. I'm trying to do what's right. Grateful for this life, even when I can't see the light. Praying that I make it through the fight, make it through the night. I'm trying to do what's right. Life is like a beautiful gift. It's a miracle that I still exist. I'm chilling on the edge of a cliff. I'm admiring the art with a heart full of bliss. From the forest to the ocean, the coast to the mountains. Life is growing as I'm flowing like a fountain. Surrounded by nature.